The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. SuggsInsurance.com. That is GSUGGS Insurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today I will be reading excerpts from two issues of Time Magazine. The first three articles are from the December 26, 2022 / January 9, 2023 edition. Person of the Year, Volodymyr Zelensky, and the Spirit of Ukraine are featured in this issue. A portrait of Zelensky is on the front cover, and that is bordered in red as usual with a narrow inner border of white. Time in large block white letters is superimposed upon a pale gray background. And these illustrations are people surrounding Zelensky's portrait of his head and shoulders. And the theme is blue and yellow, which are the colors of Ukraine. Several flags are shown in this image on the cover, as well as people. But Zelensky's portrait is the predominant illustration. So we'll go on then to another edition and excerpts, but beginning now, the women of Iran are noted as being 2022 Heroes of the Year by Time magazine. This article is written by Azada Mullavani, with and she's a former Time columnist, and she is the author of Guest House for Young Widows. In the winter of 2017, a young woman called Vida Movahed stood on top of a utility box on Revolution Street, a busy artery of central Tehran, and dangled her white headscarf on a stick. As an act of dissent, it was strikingly peaceful, giving the appearance of a white flag of surrender. Still, by not wearing her hijab, Movahed was challenging the system's dress codes. She stayed there for an hour until she was arrested for breaking the law. Imagery of her silent, brave act raced around Instagram. A month later, a graduate student named Narges Hosseini performed the same defiant act on the same street. Soon, more women launched similar protests, and their movement took the name of Where It All Began, the Girls of Revolution Street. When I lived in Tehran in my early 20s, writing a Time column called Lipstick Jihad, we used to flout the rules by wearing brilliant colors and tighter and shorter overcoats, pushing against the gloomy black and navy of official dress codes, and bringing some individuality within the bounds of attire that was meant to erase distinctiveness. It was a way of refusing to be a model Islamic citizen, of showing the state its plan had failed, and that we had rejected its conservative vision of women as dutiful wives and mothers. It was millennials who drove the Girls of Revolution Street demonstrations of the late 2010s, leaving flowers at spots that had been sites of protest, and showing the next generation how powerfully civil disobedience could challenge inequality. These younger women are now in the streets, the movement they're leading is educated, liberal, secular, raised on higher expectations, desperate for normality, college and foreign travel, decent jobs, rule of law, access to the Apple Store, a meaningful role in politics, the freedom to say and wear whatever. They're quite unlike those who came before them. Sometimes they feel more transnational, Gen Z, than Iranians. They're vegans. They de-Islamicize their names. They do not want children. I've often wondered what has made them so rebellious, because their ferocious character was evident well before 22-year-old Mahsa Jina Amini, arrested at a metro station by the morality police who enforced the dress code, died after being held in their custody September 16, setting off the most sustained uprising in the 43-year history of the Islamic Republic. The average age of arrested protesters is notably low. Iranian officials estimate as young as 15. I can only conclude that when a generation's aspirations for freedom appear tantalizingly within reach, the more humiliating the remaining restrictions seem, and the less daunting the final stretch of resistance feels. In the past 2 or 3 years, young women effectively already canceled the compulsory hijab. I was struck on a round of bureaucratic visits to government offices last summer by how casually and liberally young women dressed in even these traditionally austere official outposts. I felt ridiculous in a long black robe and navy headscarf, as though I were a tourist who'd read all the wrong travel books. I was struck when a relative told me she had received so many fines for driving without a headscarf that her driver's license was about to be suspended. She was obliged to attend a mass lecture, the equivalent of moral traffic school, and after promising to abide by the rules, her fines were canceled. The state has known for some time it is on the back foot with dress codes and is clearly spooked. Last winter, instead of the usual dreary billboards of a pious woman in black chador with some hectoring message about modesty, a panoramic image went up over Modara's expressway in Tehran of a woman in a minimalist sport hijab sprinting up a mountain with the words, "You chart the path, find yourself." At this writing, an estimated 400 Iranian protesters have been killed by security forces, though some human rights groups put the number higher, and judicial authorities are seeking harsh penalties for some of those detained. Despite measures to block the internet, reports continue to surface of deaths and abuse in custody. After nearly 3 months, protests on college campuses are not letting up, with students demanding the release of detained friends and defying gender segregation rules in plazas and classes. At the World Cup, Iran's team stood silently during the national anthem, signaling their solidarity with the protesters. Confronting the compulsory hijab is such a deft way of rejecting the wholesale failures of Iran's system that I often wonder why my generation did not take the same path. We were caught up in unwinnable battles over equal marriage and inheritance rights and other forms of legal discrimination that required us to operate within formal political spaces through formal processes. Those were arguably more important challenges, but the state had no intention of allowing such reforms, and over time, activists were so blocked they gave up. The space simply did not exist. It did not exist for feminists, and soon it did not exist for the private sector petitioning for regulatory reform, for environmentalists, for labor activists. What is happening in Iran may look familiar, but it is different, because today the aspirations of all of those who have sought change are on display, swirled into the chants of woman, life, freedom, a feminist revolt carrying a whole society's varied grievances. It is telling that even schoolgirls have been swept up into these protests. A relative's daughter told me that every day in her eighth grade classroom, someone scrawled a chant on the blackboard, and one girl even had the courage to ask what dictator meant. These words are not irrelevant to them. They're all on Snapchat and can peer into the lives of their cousins around the world. Acutely aware, they are the only ones who have to wear a school uniform that includes a hooded headscarf, as though they are Benedictine nuns. The contrast between the lives they lead, especially online, and the inherited imagery and ideological messaging of the Islamic Republic could not be more stark. The regime is devoted to martyrs. Solemn portraits of soldiers lost in the Iran-Iraq war still line freeways, though in recent years the system, as Iranians refer to their enveloping government, has recast its propaganda into content that tries to be competitive on Instagram. But these historical grudges and traumatic memories have no particular hold on Gen Z youth, who are preoccupied with their own struggles. Years of crushing U.S. sanctions that have devastated Iran's economy. Navigating life under a paralyzed dogmatic system that prefers isolation to economic and social openness. Among the many reasons the rebellion has gone on so long is the stuttering response of a government that recognizes the validity of the complaint. There are old revolutionary elites who have warned of a system that has utterly lost its way, can no longer afford to subsidize its traditional social base, has alienated everyone else, including the religious, and has subordinated the well-being of its citizens to the notion of security. An outside analyst might see a regime shaped by decades of international isolation. An Iranian analyst might see a narrow, brittle system, desperate to cling to power at any cost. An Iranian teenage girl only sees herself as the unfortunate child of what is increasingly a pariah state, cut off from the world economically, socially, and culturally. And all for what? In whose name? What are Iranians willing to suffer in order to see their demands for fundamental change realized? The question will be resolved by Iranians themselves, those inside the country who will live with the outcome of their actions. For now, the regional and wider reverberations of Iranian girls' revolt could not be more seismic. In neighboring Iraq and Afghanistan, countries where violence against women is endemic, activists have held up posters of their Iranian sisters. Feminists across the globe, especially in Europe and Latin America, see the outcome in Iran as a bellwether for their own struggles. No one, not the officials in Iran, nor governments around the world who have made hostility to women a brand of politics, saw the power of a girl standing on a utility box, demanding to be left alone. 2022 Innovators of the Year, the James Webb Telescope Team by Jeffrey Kluger. 4 years ago, Gregory Robinson wanted nothing to do with what might be the greatest spacecraft ever built. It did not at the time seem like it would ever actually become what it was promised to be, a machine that would take images from space, return them to Earth, gobsmack the public with their clarity and depth and sheer celestial beauty, the kind of beauty that could even briefly stop a fraught and fractious species like ours from the daily messes we make of our world and leave us thinking just what? Once, you know what? When we try, we can do something truly grand. What the spacecraft did seem like at the time was a massive white elephant. One that a man in Robinson's position would not want to go near. For one thing, it was grossly over budget, with a sticker price that had risen from an initial estimate in 1995 of just $500 million to $8.8 billion. For another thing, it was years behind schedule. Its launch was originally set for 2007, and here it was, spring of 2018, and still nobody could say exactly when it would leave the ground. And finally, Robinson, who was at the time NASA's Deputy Associate Administrator of Programs, liked the job he had just fine, overseeing no fewer than 114 NASA spacecraft, either already flying or in the development pipeline. Here is a photograph by NASA of Webb's image of the Pillars of Creation, a star-forming region 6,500 light-years from Earth. It looks like a splash of water is what it looks like, a wave perhaps, with at least three pillars or nozzles poking out into a rusty brown background. Now, is that rusty brown background what his space looks like to this James Webb telescope? I don't know. But it looks like something from a sea, from an ocean, has just jutted out of an entity into a brown background that, by the way, is sprinkled with tiny, bright lights. And now, here came his boss, NASA Associate Administrator Thomas Zurbrücken, offering him a dog of an assignment: give up all of those fine spacecraft with their fine missions and take over as program director of the James Webb Space Telescope. A generational project, yes, but with many blown deadlines and bloated costs and all the headaches that came with them. The telescope's launch at the time was set for less than half a year away, October 2018, and once again it looked as if it would miss its target. We have some major challenges, Robinson recalls Zurbrücken saying to him. We're starting to realize we may not make our launch date. Zurbrücken then got to his point, asking, more like insisting, as Robinson recalls, that he take over the reins of the project. You are the right guy to do it, Zurbrücken said. We have looked at a lot of different people, and you are the right guy. Zurbrücken was impressed, not just by Robinson's technical acumen, but also his skills with the workforce. The majority of problems we encountered with Webb during its previous 6 years were people and team problems, Zurbrücken said in an email to Time. Technically, most issues had been resolved, but the team had struggled to come together and execute seamlessly. This is where Greg's strengths really lie. He can walk into a meeting or launch room and walk out knowing what the energy of the team is and also what hinders their progress. All the same, Robinson resisted the Webb offer for weeks before ultimately relenting to Zurbrücken's entreaties. 4 years on, the decision looks like an eminently good one. The 7-ton James Webb Space Telescope, with its prodigious 6.5-meter, 21.3 feet, main mirror, is now situated in space, 1.6 million kilometers, 1 million miles from Earth, peering deeper into the universe and thus further back in time than any other space observatory ever built. If the Hubble Space Telescope has been NASA's astronomical workhorse for more than 30 years, the Webb is the newer, grander, more powerful racehorse. Until Webb, Hubble was best in the business, says Robinson. But to see the clarity, the differences in the images we are getting now, it just blows my mind. The public's awed reaction has mirrored Robinson's own. The Webb telescope has come to represent something larger and grander than all of us. the long effort to get the spacecraft built, the mission it was assigned, searching for clues to the very origins of the universe, have worked a certain transcendent good. From the hands of a team of thousands of researchers, engineers, and factory line workers came a ship that, if it doesn't exactly kick open the doors to the secrets of the cosmos, at least parts the curtain. This beautiful machine, says senior project scientist John Mather, has worked in every way that it was supposed to work. That beautiful work Webb is doing is a function of the wavelength in which its mirror sees the universe. Hubble scans space principally in the visible spectrum, the same wavelength with which the human eye sees. That allows it to peer 13.4 billion light years away, seeing light that's been traveling to us for 13.4 billion years, or just 400 million years after the Big Bang. But Hubble is blind to what happened in that critical earlier phase of the universe's infancy, because visible light from so far away cannot penetrate the intervening dust of interstellar space. Infrared radiation, however, cuts right through the dust, allowing a telescope that, like Webb, detects energy in that frequency to see as far as 13.6 billion light years distant. The additional 200 million years seems like a small difference, but it is not. The difference between what Hubble and Webb see is not like comparing someone who's 70 years old to somebody who's 71 years old, said Scott Friedman, an astronomer with the Webb team, in a conversation with Time last year. It is like comparing a baby who's one day old to a baby who's 1 year old. Hubble, launched in 1990, had been in space for no more than 5 years before NASA began drawing up plans for an infrared observatory that was then called the Next Generation Space Telescope. The idea was a bold one, but it seemed snake-bit from the start. Nobody had ever built a telescope like this before, and the research and development process was slow and painstaking. With the original half-billion price tag climbing steadily over the years to $1 billion in 2000, $2.5 billion in 2004, by which point the telescope had been renamed in honor of former NASA Administrator James Webb. $4.5 billion in 2006, $8 billion in 2011, and $8.8 billion when Robinson took over in 2018. That made Robinson's job a potentially thankless one, but he was not working alone. At the time he took command of the project, NASA had already empaneled an independent review board to help set Webb to rights at last. Working with the board, Robinson improved the project's efficiency rating, a ratio of scheduled tasks to completed tasks from 55% to 95%. He also made the process more transparent, holding regular meetings with the White House Office of Management and Budget, as well as appropriations committees in both houses of Congress. And Robinson made it a point to tell some hard truths. Webb, he frankly conceded, was going to be later still, not launching till the end of 2021, and would cost more still, with a final price tag of $10 billion. But those would be the drop-dead limits. I tried to be a little more realistic, Robinson says. We tend to come into these things with a hero syndrome, and that can get you into trouble. I tried to institute better schedules, better milestones. Our rule was go fast, but don't rush. Christmas Day, 2021, the James Webb Space Telescope at last left the ground aboard a European Space Agency, ESA, Ariane 5 rocket, launched from Kourou, French Guiana, in South America. Hitching a ride with the ESA was a necessity because of Webb's size, which is too big for any rocket in the American fleet. Only the Ariane 5's 5.4-meter, 17.7-foot fairing could accommodate it. Launching from French Guiana came with its own challenges. Robinson and the rest of the NASA team were on site for 3 weeks before liftoff as the telescope was loaded into the rocket and countdown rehearsals were run again and again. The jungle environment required the crew to take anti-malarial pills, tolerate ants in the hotel rooms, stay alert to the stray jaguar that would appear on or around the launch site. One night, one of our engineers came back to his hotel and found a 6-foot snake in his room, says Bill Oakes, Webb's now retired project manager. Once in space, the telescope required 3 months before it could unfold its mirror and bring all of its observation instruments online. The process required successfully overcoming 344 so-called single-point failures, a pulley or actuator or switch that if it went awry could all by itself doom the mission. The biggest challenge involved unfurling the Webb's tennis court-sized sun shield, a structure made of 5 layers of foil-like Kapton that keeps the temperature of the telescope's mirror and instruments at a frigid minus 223 degrees centigrade, which equals minus 370 degrees Fahrenheit. That bitter temperature is necessary to prevent stray heat from distorting Webb's infrared images, the way stray light can ruin optical pictures. All 344 single-point failures worked perfectly, and at last, in March 2022, the telescope switched on its 6.5-meter eye and captured its initial image. For that first picture, engineers at Webb's Mission Control Center at the Space Telescope Science Institute, STSCI, in Baltimore, turned the telescope toward an entirely unremarkable star that goes by the decidedly technical name TYC-4212-1079-1. The choice was a practical one. TYC-4212-1079-1, some 2,000 light-years from Earth, has no nearby neighbors, allowing Webb to focus on it alone. At first, the image was a mess, with all 18 of the mirror segments capturing their own image of the star. Imagine an a cappella chorus where everyone has their own key and their own song, says Webb's operations project scientist Jane Rigby. But over the course of several days, the team focused the mirror, adjusting the position of each segment on the order of nanometers, less than the width of a human hair, till the 18 blurred images resolved into a single, impossibly bright and sharp one, with hundreds of galaxies photobombing it in the background. I can tell you that I've worked with geeks my whole life, and there was no better scene, says Robinson, who was at the STSCI at the time. To see a bunch of people just falling over themselves with joy, it was a beautiful thing. I'm glad I was a part of it. In July, the whole world got to experience a similarly sublime moment when the Webb team unveiled 4 eye-popping images, including a field of galaxies known as SMACS 0723, the Carina Nebula, one of the cosmos' great nurseries for new stars, located 7,600 light-years from Earth, and Stephen's Quintet, or Stefan's Quintet, a cluster of 5 galaxies first imaged by more primitive telescopes in 1877. The big reveal took place at a White House event attended by multiple members of the Webb team. These images are going to remind the world that America can do big things and remind the American people, especially our children, that there's nothing beyond our capacity, President Joe Biden said during the event. We can see possibilities no one has ever seen before. We can go places no one has ever gone before. With that early hoopla passed, the telescope has now entered its operational phase and is settling down to do more than just deliver eye candy. Astronomers from around the world who want to conduct research on the telescope are invited to submit proposals for observation time. And the Webb team expects to receive 1,000 such pitches per year, with only enough telescope time available to accommodate about 200 of them. Despite that selectivity, Robinson, who has since retired, calling Webb the capstone of his career, sees the telescope as very much a democratic instrument. It may be owned and operated by NASA, but, Robinson says, 29 states in the U.S., 14 countries, and over 10,000 people touched this telescope. Moving now to another issue of Time magazine from August 8/August 15, 2022, into the metaverse. The next digital era will change everything. Well, that piggybacks on the James Webb Telescope story. Time is in large white block lettering upon a purple and black background with kind of goofy spaceship-type symbols. I say goofy because it looks cartoonish. It looks like something from a PBS kids show. Of course, the front cover is bordered in red. Full speed ahead, a Vietnamese electric car firm is opening a plant in North Carolina. Its ambitions are global. By Charlie Campbell, Haiphong, Vietnam. This has reporting by Eloise Berry, London. On northern Vietnam's Red River Delta, the world's most ambitious electric vehicle, EV Upstart, occupies a factory complex fringed with mango trees and palms. Outside VinFast's plant by the port city of Haiphong, fishermen in conical hats still plumb mudflats for grass carp and tilapia. Inside, each car negotiates an overhead ergonomic conveyor assembly line measuring 2.5 miles, a gauntlet of 1,250 robot arms twirling like pneumatic ballerinas, adds some 3,000 components and welds rivet after rivet in a flurry of sparks. VinFast is spelled V-I-N-F-A-S-T. Everything here is top of the line, machinery sourced from Germany, Japan, Sweden. Welding is 98% automated. Capacity is 250,000 cars a year. Impressively, instead of individual assembly lines tailored for each vehicle, the facility can simultaneously assemble multiple models on the same line. Even more impressively, Google Maps shows that half of the 877-acre site sits beneath the South China Sea, a quirk because it was reclaimed from the waves and made operational in just 21 months. VinFast CEO Li Tui likes to joke that not even the Mountain View, California behemoth can keep up with the EV maker's lightning pace. At the start, everybody said that building cars in 2 years was impossible. Some even called us crazy, she says. But we launched three car models in those 21 months. The global EV market was valued at $185 billion in 2021 and is expected to rise by 24.5% annually and reach $980 billion by 2028. VinFast is not alone in craving a slice of the pie and is aggressively targeting the U.S. and European auto markets. To succeed, it needs to either unseat Tesla or persuade gasoline car drivers to switch over. That is no small feat. China accounts for about half the global market for EVs, yet none of its firms have tried to broach the U.S. despite plowing tens of millions of dollars into feasibility studies. Skepticism is natural when it comes to the congested global EV industry. No sooner does one startup steal a march on rivals than its latest funding round burns up and another overtakes it. Today, the U.S. industry has consolidated behind Tesla, worth some $750 billion and turning its co-founder Elon Musk into the world's richest man. And legacy automakers are belatedly turning to a market whose importance is soaring alongside global oil prices. How does a parvenu from the technological backwaters of Vietnam seriously expect to compete? It is a huge challenge, but VinFast's parent, VinGroup, is no ordinary firm. Controlled by Vietnam's richest man, Pham Nhat Vuong, VinGroup is the country's largest conglomerate, with a total market value of $24.4 billion. Its 2020 revenue accounted for 2.2% of the national GDP, and its reach is staggering. "It is a remarkable story," says Vuong Le Thu, principal fellow at the Perth U.S. Asia Center and adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. "There's never been anything this size in Vietnam. It is overwhelming at one level because now you can do everything with VinGroup." Now, employees can commute in a VinFast electric car. EVs having emerged as the vehicle for the firm's ambitions to leap from domestic to international. In June 2018, VinFast purchased a GM factory outside Hanoi, and by licensing intellectual property from GM and other auto giants like BMW, began producing its first gasoline VinFast vehicles less than a year later. These initial offerings were essential ciphers of Western brands, specifically a Chevrolet Spark Compact and a BMW 5 Series sedan and X5 SUV. Because of the clever marketing and low costs, they proved immensely popular, capturing 17% to 19% of each market segment's share domestically. They were also essential learning steps. Beginning in August, VinFast switched to exclusively manufacturing EVs. The company's also set to build a $4 billion factory in North Carolina and is scouting for a European plant. The 2,000-acre site in Chatham County plans to start by producing 150,000 electric vehicles annually beginning in July 2024. Creating 7,500 jobs. It is the largest single foreign direct investment in the state's history and indicative of the scale of VinFast's ambition, which is to become one of the top global EV makers in 5 to 10 years, says Thuy, also a deputy chairperson of VinGroup. "We think we can be as good as anybody in the world." July 14, VinFast opened its first overseas showrooms in California, including a flagship store in Santa Monica. Its first two models set for the U.S. market are sleek-looking SUVs, the VF8 and VF9. It is a solid car, no rattles or anything that would indicate a problem, says Michael Dunn, founder of the ZozoGo EV market intelligence firm, after a test drive. But the U.S. market is not for the faint-hearted. China's ambitions on the global stage present a direct challenge to U.S. hegemony. President Xi Jinping's avowed desire to reclaim center stage in the world undermines American interests from Europe to the Pacific, Latin America to Africa, most egregiously spotlighted by his backing of Putin's invasion. February 4, the House of Representatives passed the America Competes Act to better challenge China technologically, economically, and diplomatically. That would have been February 4 last year. If you are Xi Jinping, you have to make the world safe for autocrats, one top State Department official tells Time. Any geostrategic ambitions Vietnam harbors are reserved for its own neighborhood, chiefly retaining influence in Laos and Cambodia. China is competing strategically with the United States. Vietnam is cooperating strategically with the United States, says Vu Vinh. Vietnam also frequently clashes with Beijing over disputed islands in the resource-rich South China Sea, and memories of China's ill-fated invasion of 1979 burn brighter than those of American misadventure in the region. Today, approval of the U.S. among Vietnamese stands at a staggering 84%. A lot of people in Vietnam take pride in VinFast, and they want to support the project. They want us to be successful, says Thuy. To electrify America's dark desert highway with Vietnam's red star. That article was considerably abridged. Next will be a couple of reviews. The first two written by Judy Berman. This is Television, A Paper Trail Through Time. Hours before dawn, November 1, 1988, four suburban middle school girls venture out to deliver newspapers and dodge threats from teen bullies, slinking home after a long night of Halloween mischief. In search of the boys who stole their walkie-talkie, they bust into an under-construction house, come face-to-face with a pair of apparent mutants, and flee into deserted streets under an angry, unnaturally fuchsia sky. Instead of fighting bullies, they're caught in some cosmic war. Paper Girls sounds a lot like Stranger Things, but for girls. And if that is what gets you to watch, so much the better. But this coming-of-age sci-fi show, based on a comic written by Brian K. Vaughan and illustrated by Cliff Chang, tells a more focused, character-driven story that is particularly refreshing on the heels of the Netflix epic's bloated fourth season. Although stacked with strong comedic actors, including Ali Wong and Nate Cordry, Paper Girls' highlight is the quartet of precocious, emotional performances by its young leads. As a time travel plot emerges and the girls catch glimpses of the women they might become, the show evolves into a poignant but also playful allegory for the gulf between childhood aspirations and adult reality. And also from Television and also reviewed by Berman, Sex and the Newly Single Gay Man. One of the oldest criticisms of Sex and the City franchise is it is not really about women. According to this theory, the four main characters are secretly avatars for gay men, like creator Darren Star and executive producer Michael Patrick King. Embedded in this otherwise reductive assumption is the understanding that when SATC debuted in 1998, it would have been impossible, even on HBO, to make an equally blunt show about queer sexuality. Now, after two American iterations of Queer as Folk, and with King overseeing Carrie Bradshaw's future in And Just Like That, Star has made a TV MA rom-com whose central characters really are gay men. Co-created with Jeffrey Richman and starring Neil Patrick Harris, Uncoupled chronicles the misadventures of middle-aged men seeking men in Manhattan. It is a lighter, more entertaining show than King's inert SATC sequel, but one marked by similar defects, from overly stylized dialogue to underdeveloped characters to a bad case of affluenza. When we meet Harris's Michael, a real estate agent, he is in bed with Colin Tuck Watkins, his finance guy partner of 17 years, on the morning of Colin's 50th birthday. The same day, Colin quietly moves out of their apartment. Then he dashes Michael's hopes of reconciliation in a text message. Michael's single friends drag him into gay dating scenes reshaped by Grindr and PrEP. In SATC terms, art dealer Stanley Brooks Oshmanskas is the lonely, career-driven Miranda and TV weatherman Billy Emerson Brooks, the promiscuous Samantha, which is fitting. Michael is equal parts vanilla Charlotte and self-dramatizing Carrie. Along with his work wife, Suzanne, Tricia Campbell, and their imperious, super-rich divorcee client, Claire, Marcia Gay Harden, these pals help Michael realize he can be a handful. Most characters are hollow archetypes, and the Manhattan they inhabit, where everyone's wealthy and talks like they're in a racy Neil Simon play, feels badly dated. "Don't you just love New York?" gushes one man Michael brings home. "Grocery shopping one minute, hooking up with a hot guy the next, and just like that. It is as if the last 24 years of Sex in the City, gay and straight, never happened." Here is a review featuring a movie, a superb rescue story with a happy ending always in view by Stephanie Zakarik. Even though we know the world is not suddenly spinning faster, it is hard to shake the feeling that time is speeding up on us. In early summer 2018, 12 boys and their assistant soccer coach were trapped for more than 2 weeks in the flooded Tom Luang Nong Non Cave in northern Thailand, their situation becoming increasingly dire as heavy rainfall threatened to engulf the cave's chambers completely. Volunteers from around the world rushed to help, but as the world watched and waited, it seemed increasingly doubtful that the boys and their coach could be brought out alive. Astonishingly, rescuers pulled it off. Yet as joyful as that news was, the world moved on quickly, as it always does. That's the wonder of Ron Howard's vivid true-life drama, 13 Lives. It suspends time for just a few hours, allowing us to put our current preoccupations on pause and marvel at just how extraordinary this rescue operation was. If we did not know the ending, this picture might be unbearably tense. Luckily, we have the benefit of being able to read the future, even as we watch 13 Lives, and that leaves us free to enjoy Howard's crackerjack storytelling skills, not to mention the picture's bracing, casually heroic lead performances. Colin Farrell and Viggo Mortensen play John Volanthin and Rick Stanton, volunteer cave divers who knew there was such a thing, from England, who are adept at complex rescues. When they arrive on the scene, they are greeted with distrust by the Royal Thai Navy SEALs entrusted with the operation, particularly Commander Kiet Terachutikul. It does not help they show up in middle-aged dad gear, having argued earlier about who took one custard cream biscuit too many from the packet. As it turns out, they are the ones who locate the boys, after barely skimming in their bulky diving gear, through a series of terrifying, slender underwater tunnels. "The old men found the boys," one of the SEALs exclaims in subtitled Thai upon their return. The old part is only half a joke. But finding the trapped boys was barely a start. Getting them out seemed impossible, involving some 3 hours of treacherous underwater swimming. The solution finally settled upon, requiring the specialized expertise of yet another rescue diver, Joel Edgerton's Harry Harris, was a gamble, with potentially chilling consequences. In case you do not remember or never knew the specifics, they won't be spoiled here. This story's been told on film before, notably in the 2021 documentary The Rescue, which incorporated footage shot by the Thai Navy SEALs during the mission. Similarly, 13 Live stresses that Valanthan, Stanton, and Harris, though they are played by movie stars, are just three links in the complex chain that made this near miracle possible. One Thai diver died during the rescue, and another later succumbed to a blood infection he had contracted during the operation. Howard is particularly sensitive in his depiction of the boys' families, who waited outside the cave for days on end, steeling themselves for a tragic outcome. And the faces of the boys themselves, alight with joy at having been found by the divers after 10 harrowing days, tell you all you need to know about why the rescuers fought so hard to get them out. If you cannot move heaven and earth, then you move a little bit of water with all your strength until the open sky comes into view. Here are a few more items Time Off recommends. Under books, Babel, in R.F. Kuang's work of dark academia, the author of The Poppy War chronicles a Chinese orphan studying at Oxford's Royal Institute of Translation, known as Babel, B-A-B-E-L. But as he digs deeper, he realizes that serving Babel may mean forsaking his motherland. Another book, I'm Glad My Mom Died. Jeanette McCurdy had her first audition when she was six. For 15 years, her mother monitored her calorie intake, diaries, income, even showers. Now, the iCarly star has written a deeply, darkly funny memoir about the fraught relationship. Another book, I Am From Here. Vishwesh Bhatt, a James Beard award-winning chef, fuses recipes cooked by his relatives in India with dishes he has shared with his community in Oxford, Mississippi. In doing so, he challenges perceptions of what defines the American South. Television. The Rehearsal. On its surface, Nathan Fielder's follow-up to Nathan For You aims to help people move forward in life by painstakingly rehearsing fraught situations. But by digging into psyches, the brilliant HBO series reveals something deeper about humanity. Television, The Last Movie Stars. Ethan Hawke's HBO Max docuseries about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward recounts one of Hollywood's most distinctive partnerships and reminds us why Woodward, who never fully got her due, was one of the finest actors of her era. Podcasts, Buffy. In this five-part CBC podcast, host Fallon Johnson makes the case that the story of musician Buffy St. Marie goes hand in hand with the story of the last 60 years of indigenous resistance. Best of all, Johnson invites the charismatic and candid singer-songwriter, now 81, to tell much of the story herself. From movies, Both Sides of the Blade. In their third film together, director Claire Denis and Juliette Binoche imbue the story of a simple love triangle with layers of complexity. The raw texture of desire embodied by Binoche reminds us why she is one of our most expressive actors. Television. Moonhaven, one word. This AMC Plus sci-fi thriller opens in 2201 on a lunar utopia whose residents have fled an ailing Earth but must return to save their fellow humans. A near future philosophical epic whose ambitious ideas compensate for minor flaws, it is a refreshing entry in a genre where subtlety can be scarce. A paragraph or so of another Zaharic review. Dunham hits the sweet spot. There was a time when we all seemed to know way too much about Lena Dunham. but even a big-time look-at-me personality can surprise you. And the writer-director's second full-length feature, Sharp Stick, counts as a surprise. This is a tender picture about the search for openness in a closed-off world, one where the internet is better at providing the illusion of interconnectedness than it is at truly connecting us. Sarah Jo, Christine Frozeth, is a sheltered 26-year-old living with her deadpan, off-divorced mother, Jennifer Jason Lee, and an aspiring Instagram influencer sister, Taylor Page, in an unglamorous Los Angeles apartment. Sarah Jo dresses like a sister wife and behaves just as demurely, though there's a reason for her sexual reticence. Painful health problems forced her to undergo a radical hysterectomy at 15, and she went through menopause at 17. Then a steamy affair with an older married man-child, John Berntal, unlocked something in her, setting her on a path of sexual experimentation and self-understanding. Sharp Stick is hardly a perfect picture, but it is a searching one, an examination of how scary it is to open ourselves to happiness. It is also a reminder that awkward sex isn't necessarily bad sex. If anything, it is the ultimate proof of our bewildering, imperfect humanness. And that last little article was read in its entirety. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.